Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Kids, crime, and public money. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Governor Brown wants to eliminate the state's division of juvenile justice. Despite recent reforms, it's been criticized as violent, abusive, and too expensive. Brown wants robbers, killers, and sex offenders aged 12 to 25 taken care of by the 58 counties. But if LA County is any example, that could make things even worse for young inmates and for taxpayers. We'll hear about a proposal that has divided experts who agree on almost everything else. Also tonight, Al Jazeera comes to Los Angeles. Later on, Republicans and the Obama White House draw the battle lines for a political war over domestic spending. First, here's the news. Norman Olney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. President Obama will release his latest budget next week, and House Republicans are divided over how much they'll try to cut it. Is John Boehner facing a mutiny? First, this story. After years of scandals over sexual violence and other forms of brutality and abuse, Governor Schwarzenegger settled a lawsuit against the California Youth Authority. Its name was changed to the Division of Juvenile Justice, and it now holds about 1,000 inmates as opposed to 10,000. But the overall costs are the same as ever, and the recidivism rate is 81%, one of the worst in the country. Governor Brown wants to shut it down and give the counties full responsibility for kids ranging in age from 12 to 25 who've been convicted of robbery, murder, and other serious crimes. Dan McAleer is executive director of the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice in San Francisco. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
You're supportive of this idea to shut it all down.
Well, the proposal to shut the system down has actually been out there for at least the last 4 years. The legislative analyst has recommended it. The state's Little Hoover Commission has recommended it, and for a number of reasons. But, you know, for the primary reason today is the fact that the state is facing a $28 billion deficit, and we simply can no longer afford to operate dual systems as we have in the past. We're closing classrooms, denying child care to parents, cutting poor and disabled and the elderly off the welfare rolls. So I mean, the state has to make a choice. Now, there's been a general trend over the last few years where juvenile justice services have been moving more and more back to the counties. 10 years ago, the old California Youth Authority, the state's youth correction system, had about 10,000 people in it, 10,000 kids. They now have about 1,300. Now, during that time, they were successfully sued because of the horrible conditions that existed in those facilities, and to some degree still exist. But with the population down, that situation has improved somewhat. But the state has not come into compliance with the major requirements of the consent decree, which mandates that they institute an entirely reconstituted system of rehabilitation within the institutions, and they haven't been able to do that. Along with that, and what I believe is going to be the primary reason why we have to shut this system down, is the consent decree requires the replacement of the old institutions. These institutions, the five remaining, most of them were built over 40 years ago. The state has said, and the plaintiff's attorneys have said, that in order to come into compliance, those institutions have to be rebuilt. At the same time, the counties, over the last 10 years, have expanded their institutional capacity to the point where we now have, on any given day, 3,000 surplus beds at the county level in various counties. There's 58 counties in the state. But the point is, the counties now have the institutional facilities to house the remaining population in DJJ. So the state's left with a dilemma here, or a question. And actually, I think Governor Brown has finally taken it on and come to the conclusion that there's no basis to maintain. There's no rational basis to continue to maintain the state system when there is an alternative available at the county level. That doesn't mean that county systems are operating in all that good a shape. Some counties are doing some excellent work. We're seeing some very good innovations occurring at the county level, where most juvenile justice services are delivered anyways. Virtually 99% of all the kids that are arrested in California on a given year are handled at the county level. So that's really where most services are delivered.
All right, Dan McAleer, again, Executive Director of the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice. Barry Crisberg is a Research and Policy Director of the Earl Warren Institute at Berkeley Law School. He's held a comprehensive investigation, or rather led a comprehensive investigation of the Department of Juvenile Justice in 2003, and he's been serving as an expert since a consent decree was signed in 2004. Good to have you on our program.
Hi, good to be here.
Thank you. In the aftermath of your investigations, or I should say in your investigations, you report some pretty grim conditions at the Department of Juvenile Justice institutions, but you don't want them shut down. Why not?
Well, that's right. And, you know, I want to start by saying, you know, over the years, there's probably been nobody who's been a sharper critic of the state youth program than me, and yes, I led that investigation, and we found horrible things. However,
what did you find? What are some of the horrible things you found?
Well, we found kids who were being held in cages. We incredible use of lockup, large numbers of youth in 23-hour lockup for months on end, out of control medical care, inadequate education. I mean, you name it, they were violating state and federal laws. There was almost no aspect of their operation that was either constitutional or met state and federal statutes. So it was a very bad system. Lots of violence, lots of gangs, you name it. But that was 8 years ago. And I think if we focus in on the way things were 8 years ago, we're making a big mistake. My biggest concern is that, first of all, and we've also dropped the population by 90%. So we've gotten out of this system a lot of youth who are the lower end, property offenders, probation violators, et cetera. And now the youth that are left present some pretty unique challenges in terms of not only their mental health issues, but also the crimes they've committed. My concern is this. We've made progress at the state level through a lot of hard work. If the only concern is save money, we could just put these young people into prison, and that would save money in the short haul, but we'd be paid back in terms of higher recidivism rates and future violence. So it seems to me, if the only issue is money, let's do that. But I think the other thing that I'm concerned about is the counties are almost totally unregulated. We really don't know what's going on in the counties, and many of the counties operate programs far worse than the state. Los Angeles, case in point. Los Angeles County is under very stringent federal civil rights consent orders because of the horrific conditions in their facilities. So to take youth out of state facilities that have gone through a reform process and then dump them into the Los Angeles disaster doesn't mean improvement. The other thing, I'll give you one example. When I did my investigation, there were about 500 kids every day who were locked up all the time, around the clock. Today, that number is less than 40. So we've made progress in certain areas. There used to be really nothing that looked like a school program. Now kids are getting education, special ed. I don't see too many counties having the resources to respond to these kids. So my fear is they will either be sent to prison. There's almost no incentive for prosecutors not just simply trying them and sending them to prison, or if they do go to the counties, they will quickly gravitate to being locked in detention centers with almost no education and counseling services.
So even though it's still
a step backwards,
even though it still costs the same amount to handle 1,000 kids roughly that it did 10,000, it's still worth doing?
No, we can certainly reduce the cost. The reason it's costing as much as it does is because of of Byzantine and kind of crazy state personnel rules. And the counties have their own share of these. So it's not the fact that it would cost as much. The cost can be brought down. We don't even know what the county costs are. They make those numbers up often. But again, the reason why the system costs as much is that current personnel rules really and union contracts have prevented the reduction in the workforce, the reduction, you know, the closure and transfer of facilities. And that has to happen. And I think the costs can come down. So, again, I don't think we should get hung up on that number. I think we should hold the state accountable for reducing those costs substantially. But, again, you know, the cheapest thing is just throw a bunch of kids into these already triple-bunked prison yards, give them nothing, and say, oh, look at all the money we've saved.
Barry Crisberg again at the Earl Warren Institute at Berkeley Law School. If the state closed the Division of Juvenile Justice, as we've heard, those very tough cases would be sent to the counties, including Los Angeles County's probation department. Civil rights attorney Connie Rice wrote an op-ed piece about the department in the L.A. Times last October. It began by describing a sign on a classroom wall in one juvenile hall, and it read, "No reading newspapers, no cell phone use, and no alcohol consumption during class." The message was not for the inmates, it was for the staff. Connie Rice, good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren, how are you?
Good. Tell us more about the county facilities.
Well, I think Mr. Crisberg has hit the nail on the head. We have a disastrous system in L.A. County. It's been a disaster for a long time. It's true, we also have reduced our population by a significant amount, but the question ought to be, why are we playing budget games? The governor needs to understand that it's not just about playing budget tricks to get to a magic number and to get something on the ballot. This is about the fact that we absolutely refuse, up and down this state, to deal with these kids. These are kids. They are rehabilitatable, but we have absolutely decided that we are not going to do any rehabilitation. The whole system exists for the convenience of the employees. It is not about getting a kid from a troubled home and getting him or her back in school and in a decent home. It's not about that. It's about, I mean, in L.A. County, we're still trying to get the employees to stop coming to work drunk. There's actually a provision in the Department of Justice, the United States Department of Justice, MOA, a paragraph dedicated to the fact that L.A. County must take care of its alcohol problems. Employees, that sign was not on butcher paper, Warren. It was a permanent sign. I think it's gone now after I wrote my editorial, but it just tells you. And I think this puts it in a nutshell. If there's an 80% rate at the state level, at least they try to calculate a recidivism rate. In L.A. County, they don't even bother. You can't even get the employees to tell you what the recidivism rate is because they don't care. It's not about whether they are processing the same kid over and over again and putting him in a cage to read a book. It's really quite outrageous. And so I think the state is playing some dangerous games. I don't think the state is serious about these kids. And L.A. County, for some reason, cannot get its act together. It needs to remain under federal receivership.
Connie Rice, civil rights attorney, co-director of the Advancement Project in Los Angeles. Zev Yaroslavsky is Los Angeles County Supervisor for the 3rd District. He's a familiar voice to our listeners. And Zev Yaroslavsky, thank you for being on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
How can you tolerate this?
Tolerate which? What Connie was describing
Connie just described?
The governor's proposal?
No, what Connie just described.
Well, there are a lot of issues that we have in our probation department and the way we treat our kids, and I don't disagree with the substance or the spirit of what Connie is saying, and it's something that has been in the making for many years at the county, and we had terrible executive leadership in the probation department. We've changed that, and it's a work in progress right now, and there's a lot of work being done in our camps and in our halls, in cooperation with the Department of Justice to try to bring the camps and the halls up to a standard, both especially educationally, which these kids deserve, because they are kids and we're warehousing them. We're not doing anything good for them for the most part. We entered into an agreement with the ACLU over our Challenger camp out in the Antelope Valley, which is one of the worst places imaginable, where we're not educating hundreds of kids that we have under our domain there. There needs to be, and there is in the process, developing a cultural change in the probation department, but there also needs to be a cultural change among policy leaders at the state, at the county level, and in the profession, that rehabilitation, not punishment, is the order of the day when it comes to kids.
Are you trying to calculate the rehabilitation rate? That would seem to me fairly basic.
You mean the recidivism rate?
Excuse me, I beg your pardon. Rate? I beg your pardon. I used the wrong word. No, of course, the recidivism rate.
Yeah, I honestly don't know what Connie's referring to on that. But can I speak to a second to the governor's budget proposal, which
sure.
is what I thought we were going to talk about here.
Well, the governor, it's proposed to put people at the county level, so and that's why we want to talk about what's going on at the counties.
And it would be a disaster. The county is not equipped now to do what we need to do for the kids we have under our jurisdiction, and to expand that responsibility right now would be a shot to our solar plexus, frankly. And I'm not, and I mean that both from a policy point of view as well as from a financial point of view. Our main problem with realignment is if the state is going to realign services, take some services that they now provide and ask counties or demand counties provide those services, then we need to know how are we going to pay for them, since the state hasn't been able to pay for them.
But to my understanding, they would be paid for by the extension of the sales income and vehicle license taxes that the governor wants to put on the ballot.
That's correct, but is that enough? And right now, with the taxes that these VLF taxes and other taxes that are being proposed to be extended, the state has gone into a $28 billion hole. So the question is, how do we avoid going into a hole or having a fiscal millstone wrapped around our neck by assuming responsibilities for services that we are not being adequately compensated for? The state, as we sit here today, owes us almost $500 million in money that is owed to us for services we have provided at the behest of the state, and it has been deferred because they don't have the money to pay for it. This could be they could basically be dumping bad debt off their books and dumping them onto our books. And I also agree with what Connie said, that this should not be, you know, realignment is a programmatic thing. From my point of view, from the state's point of view, it's a plug number. It's a budgetary issue, and they're looking to find $5.9 billion to close, and this is the way they're going to do it: shifting services from the state to local governments, primarily counties. And it begs the question: what are the programmatic impacts? What are the impacts on the clients we have? Whether it's mental health clients, whether it's juvenile delinquents who are in our system, all of these have to be looked at more programmatically than just as an accounting issue.
All right. Let me go back to our first guest, Dan McAleer, Executive Director of the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice, advocating that the state facilities be abolished. What do you say to all of this? And are you really just talking, as Barry Crisberg put it, about money?
Well, I think that the concerns that have been brought up are all legitimate, and certainly no one wants to see more kids transferred to the adult court. Certainly I don't. I think that, however, I think we need to remember that, you know, L.A. County is not the entire state. There are 58 counties, and many counties have actually run excellent juvenile justice systems and have reformed their juvenile justice systems over the last 10 to 15 years to the point where they're national models. L.A. County is not there. But, you know, if we are talking about improving the systems, about reforming L.A. County, and I've certainly in concurrence with that, it's not going to happen if we continue with the current system and we provide no additional resources to LA County. County systems will not improve unless they're provided, and I agree with the previous speaker, unless they're provided with the necessary resources to do it. Right now, we're forced to make a choice. Either we're going to continue to operate these dual systems, or as we currently do, and the counties will not get any additional resources, or we're going to have to shed one of them. There's only 370 kids in the Division of Juvenile Justice right now from L.A. County. I would say that we're spending about $200,000 per head on those kids. I would say, you know, give that money back to L.A. County and let them decide what they want to do with it. If they want to turn around and spend that $200,000 to give back to the state to house the kid, I say that would be fine. But take the money. The governor is proposing $94 million in additional money this fiscal year to help the counties take on this additional burden. And that will increase by the third year to $243 million. That's a sizable chunk of money for what are essentially 1,300 kids left in the system. It will allow us to focus our attention and our concentration at the county level where most juvenile justice services are delivered. And frankly, there's a basic tenet in the corrections field. The most effective services are delivered at the point closest to where the kid comes from. So so that should be the tenet that we operate from. I fully agree that we need to bring the resources to L.A. County. We need to reform L.A. County. And I think having people like Connie Rice there to sue the county when they're not into compliance, the Board of Supervisors coming down hard on the probation department to bring those reforms about, you'll see reform. It's not going to happen overnight, but it's not going to happen if we don't do anything to make it happen.
Connie Rice, let me go back to you. You mentioned what you think is the necessity of having the federal government involved in all of this. So what if the county did somehow get more money from the state? Do you think it could use it effectively and improve the system sufficiently that it could take on these additional inmates from the state?
They could take on the additional inmates, Warren, but I think that they would mess them up as much as they mess up the current inmates. So it's not about capacity. There's capacity. The question is what's going to happen to these kids who are here and what's going to happen to the kids that are going to get sent back down here. And the real issue is that we have got to get, and I have to say that with Cal Remington as part of the new executive leadership of county probation, Cal Remington did a searing and excellent report that diagnosed the dysfunction. We need to get an outside task force because the county does not have the employees who are capable of carrying out these changes. You need an expert task force along with the feds and along with the best people in LA's academies and universities to implement that executive change plan. I mean, and it's everything from teaching employees that 40 hours is required for a full work week. I mean, the skill gap inside of county probation is astonishing. And so we've got to start from scratch. And there's enough money. It's just that we're wasting it. Give me $200,000. I'd guarantee you a kid will be turned around. So there's enough money in this system. We are simply wasting it on bad strategies, incompetent staff, and stupid visions for what we're supposed to be doing for these kids. We're not doing a thing for them but making them worse.
So, Supervisor Yaroslavsky, is this the same thing that happened to the King Drew Hospital, which had to be shut down?
Well, let me go back to the issue of the money for a second. The governor is proposing to give counties money in the realignment in the first 5 years. These extensions of the taxes are an extension for the next 5 years. In year six, those monies disappear. And one of the questions that every county in California, whether it's YOLO or LA County, is asking is, what do we do in year six? Where does the money get replenished? And that's the bait and switch that we're all very concerned about. And we're looking for a constitutional guarantee, frankly, if we're going to get into this realignment program, that we have a constitutional guarantee that ensures that we won't be left holding the bag in year six. You know, we can go round and round about the probation department is not defensible, and I'm not going to go on your show and defend the probation department any more than Connie Rice is. It needs to be reformed. It's not going to be reformed by the Justice Department. It's not going to be reformed by Connie Rice. It's going to be reformed by the County of Los Angeles with pressure from people like Connie Rice and the Justice Department. Justice has been working with us for several years. And I have to say, not with tremendous results over our camps and in our halls. We need to have top flight executive leadership, which we brought in last year, and we need to buttress the management team at the probation department, and then go down through the ranks of the department and to the best of our ability to change the culture of the department that has been anemic, to say the least, when it comes to putting the kids' interests first. I agree with the proposition that these are kids. There's a reason why our laws treat kids differently than adults. They can be salvaged. They can be turned into productive citizens. We're not doing it. We have a year with some of these kids in our camps, sometimes more, and we're not producing anything in the way of education, reading skills, mathematics skills, living skills, nothing. And that's what we brought in Don Blevins and Cal Remington to help turn around. They are not going to do it alone. It's a work in progress, and what we need is help and support for change, not continuing to pick pick apart the department for the obvious ills it has been experiencing for the last 10 years.
Okay. Again, Zev Jaroslawski, L.A. County Supervisor. Barry Crisberg, I want to go back to you with the Earl Warren Institute at Berkeley Law School. You don't want to see the state system taken apart, even though you did a scathing report on it, and you're now one of those who maintains the or tries to maintain the standards required by a consent decree. Do you think the counties, Los Angeles or others, could bring themselves up to speed if they had a sufficient amount of money from the state?
My answer is no. I don't think money is the answer, because the counties can be the same sort of black hole that the state can be. Where the counties have made significant reforms, by and large, it's because of lawsuits. They've responded to litigation and pressure, from a variety of groups. So the fact of the matter is, wherever we've seen progress, it's only because somebody has held them accountable. I would go the other direction, which, by the way, I'm on board with the Little Hoover Commission, which recommended that we maintain a 500-bed state system, but also strengthens state oversight and regulation. Right now, we've got laissez-faire juvenile corrections with no ability, really, for somebody to say, you're violating state regulations and laws, so we're shutting you down. As long as there is no accountability at the county level, things are and we have budget crises, juvenile justice is going to get the last bit of this. And, you know, by the way, the money thing, you know, I really would suggest that the supervisor take a close look at that budget. There is no money. Basically, what we're doing is we're moving money that now is being spent on other human services and dedicating it to the probation department. It's not like, because there's no new money being generated by the governor. It's just those taxes which are now being spent on some activities are now going to be dedicated to probation departments. So what that means is you're going to be closing after-school programs. You're going to be cutting down a whole bunch of human services so that probation gets another payday. And again, given the track record of probation departments at the local level, who, by the way, from my point of view, are getting lots of money. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of state funding that goes to the probation departments with very little evidence that they do much good with it. So, again, you know, I don't want to give up on a state system which has gone through substantial positive reforms and bet on a system that hasn't even started yet.
Connie Rice, I didn't get the chance to ask you, do you think the state system ought to be preserved? Is it at least better than the kind of disaster that you and the supervisor as well predicted if, in fact, all these kids come to the county?
I don't know. For now, I would say keep it aloft, because we don't have anywhere for it to land right now. And even if it's just for a couple of years, we can't be playing budget games with people's lives. And that's what this state is getting ready to do. And I can't condone that. At our level here in L.A. County, there's no excuse. There's just no excuse. There's absolutely no political will to get this done.
Well, what about the new people that both you and the supervisor mentioned?
It remains to be seen whether Cal Remington and Blevins are going to get the support that they need. I'm hoping that they will. I like the fact that Bill Fujioka is there now. I like the fact that Remington is there now. They do need some time to carry things out, but I think the job is a little bit too big for just two change agents. In other words, when Bratton came in to reform LAPD, he came in with his own army. I don't see the army. You can't put change agents in at the top for a massive bureaucracy and expect to be able to make the kind of change we're talking about. So I think there's a question mark as to whether there's a sufficient backup, and it has to come from outside. Bratton did it from the outside, and he found the change agents from the inside, and he changed LAPD's culture enough to get out from under the consent decree and to put LAPD on the right track. I don't see that similar dynamic with probation yet. I'm not ruling it out. I hope to help Cal Remington and Blevins, but we need to get our Bunsen burners burning. There's no excuse for what we do in L.A. County.
Supervisor, we got about 30 seconds left.
nothing that Connie said I would disagree with. I think it's a work in progress, and they need the support. They need the support both from the Board of Supervisors and from the Chief Executive Officer. We're arguing right now over whether to accept a grant of $28 million to redo one of our camps, which would be a tremendous opportunity for us to set a template for reform. And there's reticence on the part of the county administration and some members of the board to accept the grant that would help us do that. So there's a cultural change. There simply needs to be a total redo on the part of how we look at these kids.
Okay.
And they can be rehabilitated. They're here to be rehabilitated, to be taught, not to be punished.
All right, that's all the time we have. I want to thank you all. Xavier Oslowski, Los Angeles County Supervisor, Connie Rice, with the co-director of the Advancement Project in Los Angeles, Barry Crisberg at the Earl Warren Institute at Berkeley Law, and Dan McAleer, Executive Director of the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice. Many thanks to you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye.
I'll be right back with Which Way L.A.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayLA. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
We're only back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way LA. In the New York Times, columnist Frank Rich wrote that millions of Americans want the comprehensive and sophisticated news coverage provided by Al Jazeera, the service based in Doha, Qatar, and which has helped change the Middle East. Rich accused those he called America's corporate gatekeepers of censorship, like that of the Soviet Union's communist leaders. In Los Angeles, the public TV station KCET may no longer air PBS News, but it has started airing Al Jazeera English. Brett Marcus is Senior Vice President and Chief Content Officer at KCET. It's good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
Are you breaking through some kind of censorship here?
No, I think we're doing our best to give our viewers different perspectives and alternatives to the American coverage they normally watch.
What determined that Al Jazeera would be on your station?
Well, we carry Al Jazeera on one of our digital stations, Megahertz Worldview, and we decided in light of what's happening in the Mideast that it would make sense to also carry it on the main channel.
So what time is it available then, and how often?
Well, we've been running their newscast live at 11 a.m., 4 p.m. and 11 p.m. at night, but we've been monitoring it. So, for example, this morning we went on the air at 9:30 in anticipation of President Mubarak's speech. And we also stream it 24/7 on our internet website.
So it's no longer then just on the digital station.
Correct.
You can get it on your cable channel if it provides you with KCET.
Yes, that's true.
Okay. Have you had a chance to watch it and determine whether or not it meets your standards?
Yes, I've watched a lot of it, both in the last couple of weeks and prior to that, as a producer at Network News and all the rest of that. And our story editor, Peggy Halter, who I believe worked with you, came from Al Jazeera English.
She was in Washington working for that
station.
Yes,
that's correct. So I think their coverage has been very good. I think the days of them being criticized for being overly prejudiced or just taking one point of view are over. It's gotten praise all over the world for its coverage.
Well, let me ask you more about KCET. You've got the BBC World News. You've got Israeli Broadcast
Right.
News. You've got Al Jazeera. You've got NHK from Japan.
Correct.
Do you have any American news coverage at all?
Not at the moment, although I'm the executive producer of SoCal Connected, which is, of course, a regional weekly newscast.
So how do you justify that, an American station, a public radio or television station, rather, in this major market that doesn't cover a major American newscast or doesn't broadcast one?
Well, I think the newscasts we do carry, particularly BBC World News, do a pretty good job of covering this country. And I think what we're trying to do, there are plenty of places to find that other coverage on commercial stations, cable networks, and I think we're offering a different perspective at this point that's important for people to have.
You wouldn't look to the BBC for coverage of the governor's race in Texas, though, would you?
Well, you never know who's reporting it, and it might have a different point of view. I think that's you were reading Frank Rich's column in last Sunday's New York Times, and I think the point he made was, you know, that Americans tend to be somewhat myopic in their understanding of the Mideast. And one way to get over that is to expose yourself to lots of different points of view.
So this is a public service of a different kind, then, it seems to me. How's it doing in terms of the ratings, or is it too early to tell?
Well, I think it's too early to tell, but what's interesting is that clearly there are viewers out there who are looking to find the latest information and find it in different places. There's been a direct correlation with the events in Cairo. For example, I think the highest rated day was a week ago Wednesday when there was the rioting in Cairo in the square, and the troops intervened and the police and all the rest of that. You could see a real spike in the ratings in terms of viewers coming to find that coverage.
Well, tomorrow, after President Mubarak said he wasn't going to resign, it's expected that there's going to be an enormous number of people on the street. Maybe there'll be more people watching KCET.
Well, we also, we plan on continuing the coverage tomorrow, and SoCal Connected has done a number of special reports on this. We're doing one at 8 o'clock tomorrow night. So we're trying our best to cover it. And again, we don't consider this the only source of news people should have. I think, you know, someone who's been in the news business a long time, I think, you know, an informed viewer or reader owes it to himself or herself to watch and read a lot of different sources of information.
You said that events in Egypt were one of the principal reasons that you decided to air Al Jazeera. When things calm down there, will you take Al Jazeera off?
No, we're talking to them about continuing to run it.
So you'll run it indefinitely then?
Well, it's hard to tell at this point, but I think it's a valuable service. I mean, the implications of what's happening in the Mideast, you know, to one of our strongest allies and to Israel and all the rest of that, have a real effect on this part of the world.
It has been controversial, as you indicated earlier. A lot of people have said that coverage was inadequate and very biased. Have you had any complaints?
No, the irony is I think we've had one negative email. Most of the emails on Twitter, on whatever, Facebook, have been very, very positive, with the notion that, you know, it's nice to be able to find a different point of view and find Al Jazeera somewhere on television locally.
Okay, Brett Marcus, Senior Vice President, Chief Content Officer at KCET. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you for having me.
Check out our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, fire-breathing House Republicans challenge President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner on Which Way LA. Foreman Olney back with Which Way LA. In his State of the Union speech and his address to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, President Obama has reached out to conservatives. At the same time, he promotes what he calls investments in a new economy. Republicans now control the House of Representatives, where all financial legislation has to originate, and they're divided over how many billions of dollars they'll try to cut from the spending plan the president will unveil next week. Speaker John Boehner may face a mutiny. Stephen Moore is a member of the editorial board and senior economic writer for the Wall Street Journal. He's also author of Government, America's Number One Growth Industry. Stephen Moore, good to have you back on our program.
Hi, Juan.
Tell us, what kind of problems John Boehner faces over, will it be $100 billion? Will it be $70 billion? How many billion dollars are they going to try to cut?
Well, this is an amazing fight that has emerged on the Republican side of the aisle in the GOP caucus in the House, where you have some of these fire breathers who were elected for the first time by the Tea Party movement, who want to cut spending as fast as they can and as much as they can. And Paul Ryan, who, as you know, Warren, is the House Budget Committee chairman and a staunch fiscal conservative, has put together a budget that would cut $100 billion out of the budget, as the Republicans promised, but over 2 years, not just 1 year. And so what is interesting is that the fire breathers, the freshmen, want all those cuts to happen in the first year. And so this is going to be a fight that emerges over the next couple of weeks.
What about the deficit ceiling? That's also going to be disputed.
Well, I think there's no question about that. I think that at some point, Warren, I don't know if it's going to come in the next couple of months or in the next 6 months, but I do believe there will be a showdown, as you said at the top of this segment, between the president and the Republicans in the House about how much to cut out of this budget. I wouldn't be surprised if this isn't a reprise of, as you recall, what happened in 1995 when the Republicans took Congress and there was the government shutdown fight with President Clinton.
So it's going to get to that, you think, then?
Well, I'm not. Let me step back for a minute. I don't predict a government shutdown because I think Republicans don't want to see that happen. As you recall, that didn't turn out so well the last time that happened in the fight against Clinton. So the Republicans I've talked to, including John Boehner, say no, there will not be a government shutdown. But you know, we might come right up to the brink of it.
Okay, Stephen Moore, again with the Wall Street Journal and the editorial board and senior economic writer there. Robert Borisaj is co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. That's an organization of liberal and progressive Democrats, a progressive activist group in Washington founded to put forth a populist economic agenda for our country's future. Robert Borisaj, always good to talk with you.
A pleasure.
What's your take on the way that the president has responded since the last election, particularly in his speech to the Chamber of Commerce, in his State of the Union speech, as he tries to reach out to conservatives and reach out to business?
Well, I think he's tried to make it clear that he's ready to work with Republicans, which is a necessary thing, given that they control the House of Representatives. And I thought he was quite sensible in laying out an investment agenda that would be vital to building any strong economy in infrastructure, research and development, and education and training. He went to the Chamber of Commerce in part, I think, because the Chamber does support greater investment in infrastructure, and so he wanted to enlist them in that cause.
How do you feel, though, about what appears to be a kind of Clinton-esque change in his general overall posture moving toward the center, if not the right?
Well, I think he's at the chamber, certainly he sort of mouthed all of the conservative talking points in some ways, you know, that it's time to turn to deficit reduction now instead of jobs, that the focus of deficit reduction should be on domestic discretionary spending instead of on revenues or on health care or on defense spending, that corporate trade accords generate jobs, that he even enlisted in the right-wing assault on public workers by, instilling the freeze on federal employee salaries. I think the strange thing about this is that it's not only bad policy, it's very bad politics. It's not where the center of the country is, and it doesn't begin to solve the problems. You know, if you ask Americans what the big problems the country face, overwhelmingly they say the economy and jobs. And Republicans have this mandate wrong. The country wants this economy to get back working, and cutting jobs now, cutting spending now, isn't going to help much.
Robert Borisaj at the Campaign for America's Future. Matt Bennett is a Democratic strategist, vice president for public affairs at Third Way. That's a nonprofit organization of centrist Democrats. Matt Bennett, good to have you on our program.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Do you think that the president was, as Robert Borisaj put it, engaged or enlisted, rather, in a right-wing assault on public workers? And is he wrong, Robert Borisaj, about the direction of the country?
On the first question, I think not. There's no question that with the freeze on discretionary spending and the freeze in government salaries, that's going to have an impact on government workers. But I think the president's been very careful not to denigrate public service and not to denigrate the value that public workers bring the way that some on the right do, where they deride bureaucrats and the like. And President Obama never does that. He's very careful about that. But I think he's very realistic also. As Bob pointed out, he's going to have to work with these guys. They control the House of Representatives. And I hope there won't be a government shutdown, but there certainly might be. And he's going to have to cut deals that involve cuts to discretionary spending, even cuts that he doesn't particularly agree with. So I do think that he has gone towards the center without question, but he's done that for both political and substantive reasons.
Stephen Moore, back to you, our Republican on the program, or conservative at least. Is there any appetite in the Congress to work with the White House, particularly among those people you described as fire breathers? Are they going to go along with the idea, even if it's the Chamber of Commerce supports it, of more federal money for infrastructure?
Oh, no, I don't think there's any question they will not. I mean, we've had a deluge of spending on infrastructure over the last 2 years and over the last 10 years. I mean, we've bill. We had, you know, don't forget, in 2007, we have the biggest transportation bill in the history of America. So we've been pouring a lot of concrete. The problem in the country is not enough infrastructure. You know, I would disagree with Mr. Borshaw's. I think that the big, I agree that the big problem with the U.S. economy is not enough jobs. And to get back jobs, we have to cut taxes. We have to get this budget deficit down. And the other thing that Americans, I think, the polls show very clearly, next to jobs, they want government spending cut. They want the government on a diet. And I think we're going to see that. And Warren, we're going to probably see cuts from Republicans and a lot of programs you like. As I was telling your producer, we may see National Public Radio become National Private Radio after this Congress is over.
I'm involved to some extent as a employee of a public radio station, although I don't work for NPR. Our program is produced by Public Radio International and
right.
and KCRW in Santa Monica. Bob Borisov, what do you say to that? Cutting taxes, dealing with the deficit, cutting spending—the best way to promote jobs?
Well, we've already cut taxes to an extreme degree, and it hasn't been working. We have lower tax revenue now, where it's down to 14% of GDP or something than we've had in decades. The problem we've got is an economy that's stagnant. You know, the business people left the Chamber of Commerce speech and said, "Well, we're not investing. We're sitting on $2 trillion. We're not investing because we don't have demand. And the way to create demand is you got to put people to work. Cutting spending across government, which is the one thing that can, in fact, get people going at this point, is a very bad idea. On the other thing about
why
where
do you
the
say
public
that?
Is, let me say this on the public is. There isn't, you know, the public's in a very different place than I think Republicans are going to find out. You go down on the cuts they're talking about, cuts in funding for education, for poor schools, public opposes it 3-1, cuts in the Food and Drug Administration opposes it 2-1, cuts in transportation opposes it 3-1. Once you get under the cat, everybody thinks government wastes money, and so everybody's for cutting spending if you can cut the waste. But once you get to the kinds of cuts they're going to try to make, they're going to find that the public's not with them.
Isn't that right, Stephen Moore? Everybody wants to cut money for somebody else, but when they realize their own services are at stake, then they're not in favor of it anymore.
You know, that used to be true, but I think given the fact that we now have $1.5 trillion deficit, and I think the American people have really grown up a lot, and they understand that we have a massive spending problem. We had a $800 billion stimulus bill that didn't create a single job. In fact, we lost jobs. And I think the American people understand if we want a strong future with jobs and prosperity for our future, we've got to start paying our bills. We've got to get spending under control. And so I think people are willing to say, look, we can take some of these cuts, even in programs that I might support, because it's so much in America's national and economic interest.
Matt Bennett, back to you, our centrist Democrat. Do you think the White House is moving in the direction of what we just heard from Stephen Moore? Is that the way they're going to try to deal with this Republican-controlled House?
No, it's clearly not. In fact, just the other day, they proposed a $53 billion spend on high-speed rail, which we think is the right thing to do. And I think I'm a little closer to Bob's point of view here. You got to remember, when it comes to deficits, that there's no question that deficits are having a huge impact on the economy, and they're having a huge impact on our politics. I think people are deeply concerned about deficits. But what House Republicans are talking about doing is kind of monkeying around with 14% of the budget, which is dedicated to discretionary spending of the type that we've been talking about here, things like FDA and EPA. Those things are popular in their particulars. And I do think that Bob's right that the public is not going to like the particular cuts that are being proposed. But they're not even talking about where the real money is. The real money in the budget deficit is with Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and National Defense. If we don't get serious about those four things eventually, we cannot grapple with the deficit. And all of this will just be sound and fury that signifies really nothing.
Stephen Moore, are the fire breathers and the other Republicans concerned about those things too?
This is one of the things I get so annoyed with, you know, when Democrats say, well, all the money is in the entitlements. Those are the programs we have to cut. That is true. But look, the first bill that Republicans passed was a repeal of this 30 million additional Americans on Medicaid under the Obamacare plan. I mean, look, if we want to get serious about cutting entitlements and getting these health care costs under control, we absolutely have to repeal Obamacare. We can't afford to put 30 million more people on the Medicaid system. So repealing Obamacare is entitlement reform.
Bob Borisage, your response to that?
Well, I think Stephen Moore represents kind of a wingnut version of economics that almost every legitimate economist doesn't agree with. There isn't a legitimate economist that wouldn't say that the Recovery Act and the Obama Recovery Act didn't create jobs and keep this country from a free fall in the economy. And there isn't, you know, the CBO says rightly that the Obama health care plan was the first step towards getting our health care costs under control, which also gets Medicare costs under control. It has massive numbers of savings devices in it, which the CBO projects even conservatively as saving over $1 trillion over the next 10, 20 years. So Republicans have this problem, which if they want to repeal the health care law, they have to first trash the CBO figures because they can't replace the money that it projects we're saving.
Stephen Moore, are you, we just heard the term wingnut, are you a fire breather, and do you agree with that element of the Republican Party?
Well, look, I mean, I'm being accused of being a wingnut, and he's saying that putting 30 million more people on Medicaid is going to save money. I don't think anyone believes that. And I would just ask Mr. Borisage, what jobs is he talking about? I mean, we've had 20 straight months of 9% unemployment. We were supposed to have less than 8% unemployment with this $800 billion, and we actually lost jobs. So there's no evidence whatsoever that a single job was created by this $800 billion waste.
Okay, we got a minute left. I want to go back to Matt Bennett and ask you to respond to Stephen Moore's challenge with regard to health care reform. If, in fact, those various programs you mentioned are the real problem, are we, in fact, adding to it with Medi-Cal reform?
No, absolutely not. Bob's right about this. What House Republicans have been unable to explain is how they're going to deal with the CBO numbers, which show very clearly the deficit would go up massively if we were to reform the health care reform law. So that's just not true. He's undercounting a lot of things and overcounting a lot of other things, and this is a kind of a complex, wonky debate. But the fact of the matter is, there are a lot of other things beyond the health care law having to do with Social Security retirement age, Medicare, and how it's administered that both sides, or many on both sides, agree we have to grapple with if we're going to get serious about these long-term structural deficits.
So, Bob Borisage, quickly then, where are these jobs?
Well, the jobs we've had job growth for the last 13 months after being in free fall with the crisis that took place under the Bush administration, and the reason for that, as people were tightening their belts and state governments were cutting back, was the federal government started spending money. That's the way it works, and there isn't a sensible economist that wouldn't tell you that.
Okay, if you think this is a lively debate, wait till the president introduces his budget next week. We'll be covering that, of course. In the meantime, thanks to Robert Borisage with the Campaign for America's Future, Stephen Moore on the editorial board and senior economic writer for the Wall Street Journal, and Matt Bennett with the Third Way nonprofit group of centrist Democrats. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Producers of Which Way LA are Sonia Geis, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Andrea Brody, Katie Cooper, and Gary Scott. Our managing producer, Karen Ranziner. Technical director, Mike Newport. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. You can email us. You can share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/WhichWayLA. And you can join a conversation on Which Way LA's Facebook page. I'm Orman Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.